Hello, this is Dr. Gary Sherman, the Heart Guy, and I welcome you to another exciting and informative podcast titled The Heart Guy Presents the Heart of the Matter, bringing you interesting discussions and conversations related to the vast and important subject of heart disease and heart failure and everything related to that in today's ever-changing world. I'm extremely honored to have as my special guest today an inspiring leader in the heart and lung transplant global communities, Dr. David Weil. Dr. Weil has been the director of lung and the heart-lung transplant program and founder of the Center for Advanced Lung Disease at Stanford University Medical Center. Dr. Weil is an author as well as a consultant to leading transplant programs in occupational lung disease. Dr. Weil has also been a director and professor at Stanford, University of Colorado, and the University of Alabama, Birmingham. He has published over 45 peer-reviewed journals and is the co-author of many healthcare publications and textbooks. Dr. Weil is currently the principal owner of the Weil Consulting Group and has written an astonishing book titled Exhale, Hope, Healing, and a Life in Transplant, which I can't wait to talk about today. Dr. Weil, welcome to the Heart of the Matter.
Thanks for having me, Gary. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure and my honor indeed. So I figured we'd start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and when did you know you were going to be a doctor?
So I grew up in New Orleans, and the answer to the second question was early on. my father was a physician, and I write about some of this in the book, where I would make rounds with him on the weekends. I was the kind of person that would work in the hospitals when I was in high school and college. So I don't remember ever thinking I was going to do anything other than become a doctor, which can be, I guess, good or bad, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah. And you started your journey close to home, understandably, at Tulane University School of Medicine. I guess that was so you could be in close proximity to your family there.
Yeah, I did. I went to undergraduate and med school at Tulane. My father was still on the faculty at that time at the medical school when I was a student, which made for some interesting times when your dad's on the faculty and you're a student. But nonetheless, got a great education at Tulane. There was at the time a big public hospital called Charity that sat in the middle of downtown New Orleans, where we got our clinical rotations done. And it was a great training ground for people that wanted to learn clinical medicine. So I was blessed to be able to train there.
Yeah. And I suppose outside looking in, people think having your father on the faculty is a big advantage, but you're suggesting that it's not necessarily all it seems.
No, it actually, I didn't see it as an advantage. So whenever we had a class of 125 people, and whenever somebody needed somebody to come down and interpret an X-ray or read an EKG or do something for the entire class, it was always me coming down to the front of the class to read those X-rays. Wow. And I actually write about a scene in the book where I did that.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. A lot of pressure early on, but it probably worked well for you.
I think ultimately it was okay, but a lot of sweaty moments in front of the whole class.
That's great. Okay, so let's start with the basics, which I'm sure aren't so basic. Can you share with me how does the transplant process work? Explaining a little about what the framework of this process involves. What does that all look like from your standpoint?
Yeah, so patients come to see us with a variety of lung and heart problems, actually. And, you know, for the process really starts with a referral to the center. So the patient will have a disease that is amenable to a lung or heart-lung transplant. And what happens at that point is we decide, you know, whether or not we should do the full evaluation of that patient after we meet them, meaning 3 days of outpatient testing. Once they get this testing, we then decide whether or not they go on the waiting list. And a lot of the scenes from my book are instances where we have this meeting every week. It's called the selection meeting, and it sounds kind of ominous, but we're actually sitting around a table, doctors and nurses and social workers, deciding who does and who does not get to go on the waiting list. And it's an awesome responsibility if you think about it, because you'd like to think that all of the decisions are objective ones, but they're not. They're actually subjective in a lot of different ways. And, you know, I think I was always, even earlier in my career, amazed at, you know, the responsibility and kind of the power that we had.
Yeah. Yeah, I can, and again, I can understand that as somebody who's still waiting for their call, so to speak.
Right.
I know that there is a process, and I know that there's a fairness to it, certainly to for the most part. But then, you know, as most of our decisions are, some of it has to be subjective.
That's right. That's right. And you know, we try to limit as much as we can the subjective part of it. But you know, it's very difficult to keep it out entirely because we are human beings, after all, doing this kind of work. So
yeah, and again, that's something that people have to realize. As much as you know, they have the respect they have for you, you're a human being, and you're going to make decisions. You know, in the way that we do.
That's right.
When you were going through your training, you clearly needed to develop over an exceptionally long time the technical skill to be able to perform the most challenging of surgeries. What other lessons did you learn at that point that most of us do not realize is involved in the world of lung and heart transplantation that you could share?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I actually think the physical skills of what we do, whether you're a surgeon or a physician, are the easy part. That's the easy part, I think. Mm. I think the difficult part really is to be able to think on your feet, make decisions quickly and accurately, and also deal with, you know, a vast amount of information coming at you minute by minute, second by second. You know, it's amazing. And this actually changed during the course of my career. It's amazing how much data we have to assimilate and process, and how quickly we have to process it. I think you need, you know, to use computer language, a very good processor to be good at this job. And I also think that you have to be able to learn how to control what is an uncontrollable process. You have to try to rein in all the different variables that go along with transplant, predict what can go wrong, and, you know, really be able to see around the corner, if you will, because transplant, the one thing that's interesting about it and kind of attracted me to the field is how many curveballs get thrown at you, because it's a field that doesn't follow a playbook, you know.
A lot of it,
even those of us who have been at it, you know, I've been at it 3 decades now, I mean, it's a very unpredictable field, I would say.
Yeah, and then there's so many variables that affect whether an operation will take place at all, even up to the last moment, I suppose.
No, that's exactly right. I think some of the most profound moments in my career have been those that are associated around the waiting list. I think that waiting period, you know, especially for the patients that go through it, you know, it was a very emotionally trying period. I went through it with my father, who ended up getting a liver transplant about, you know, 20 years ago, who, you know, had ups and downs while waiting on the list. It's, you know, you're waiting for the phone to ring, and that's tough. And on the physician side, we're also having to take appropriate risk in selecting a donor, but not too much risk that the organ won't work, whether it's a heart or a lung. And I think that, you know, that finding exactly that sweet spot is a real challenge.
Yeah. And some of your, you know, patients are emergent, and some, you know, like me, are not necessarily emergent. So
right,
those decisions are made based on that as well.
That's right.
Also, so that it's an interesting process for sure. You mentioned that your father had gone through liver transplant. What impact did that, and does that still have on you as a transplant doctor?
Yeah, so my father developed hepatitis C as a result of a blood transfusion. He had hip operations. He had bad hips and got 4 hip surgeries, and obviously got infected blood somewhere along the way, probably in the 70s, and developed hepatitis C cirrhosis. Ended up needing a liver transplant while I was at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, and they happened to have an outstanding liver transplant program there. And just going through the waiting period with him and then the post-operative recovery with him and my mother was just, you know, extraordinarily revealing, because here I was, a transplant doctor, thought I knew a few things. I had been in the field about 5 years post-training at that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, thought I kind of knew what was going on, but I didn't. And you can't really until you walk through the process with one of your family members.
And yeah.
So I think so I think the field changed for me after that. It became much more personal. It was less about, you know, okay, I'm going to do a transplant and the mechanics of it and so forth. It was more about, hey, this person has a mother and a father and a sister and a brother. And you know, I think the field changed for me. It definitely did.
Yeah. And to that, I can tell you as a patient, the bigger effect was on my wife and on my sons, even more than it was on me, if that's not hard to believe. As a patient, yeah. I can tell you that's the case. And so we're looking for ways to increase the support that we can give caregivers in this process too, which is something that's a whole another field that we're trying to help, solve.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense to me. It's a worthy goal.
Yeah, yeah. And in the book, you share much of your personal journey, not only about becoming the surgeon you are today, but you really take the reader inside how these profoundly complex operations affect the patient, the caregivers, and you, the surgeon. At the point at which you begin a surgery, does the responsibility that is placed on your shoulders enter into your mind, or are you just in the zone and even, in fact, enjoying the experience of the operation?
Yeah, so just to be clear, and I make this clear in the book, I don't do the surgeries myself. So what I am is I'm what's called a transplant pulmonologist. Yep. So my role is to put patients on the waiting list, pick out a donor for them, and then the surgical team has that period, 6 to 8 hours, where they do the operation and then drop them back off to me and my team in the ICU, and then we take care of them the rest of their life.
Oh, I see.
And so, mm-hmm. and so during the period, I directed the program, for instance, at Stanford. So I'm in charge of logistics of making sure that the right surgical team's there, we pick the right donor, we've got the right recipient, the postoperative care is right. So actually during the actual surgery is the time that I have to plan for the postoperative recovery. Right. And so I have to predict, you know, how the surgery is going to go. I have to try to figure out what complications might happen in the ICU when me and my team take care of them. So that's my role in it.
Right. And the aftercare is as important or more than the surgery itself, given that, you know, of course, you know, given that the patient survives the surgery, things can go awry afterwards just as easily.
Yeah, I think, you know, and my surgical friends and I talk about this all the time. We don't have a chance if the surgery doesn't go well. Mm-hmm. But I think that we all agree that the surgery is a period that we have to, you know, we have to have technical proficiency during the surgery. But we also have to have a medical team that can take care of the patient in the ICU and beyond. And there's, you know, obviously, hopefully, you know, many years relationship between us and the patients at that point, whereas the surgeon, I think, has a more finite role, an important role, don't get me wrong, but a more finite role in the care of the patient.
Yeah. And I think that some of the surgeons, as I've come to know, my new surgeon actually at North Shore University Hospital in New York is both, as you are, a heart and lung transplant doctor. Mm-hmm. And I know that he participates more in the aftercare than, say, most cardiothoracic surgeons that are just doing the heart transplant.
Yeah, the model, it's interesting. The model, I've seen it evolve over the course of the years I've been involved. So in the early 90s, the cardiothoracic surgical team and the lung and heart teams were pretty involved together. As things evolved, the postoperative care became more on the medical team. In other words, the surgeons, you know, had been up all night doing the operation. They had, you know, they might have another surgery to do. There was a non-transplant case the following day. They were very willing, I think, and grateful to drop the patients off, if you will, in the ICU to let us take care of them, because really they had, you know, their part of it was really mostly done. I mean, you know, they sewed these organs in, they got them to work. The complications afterwards are largely medical, although, you know, there's bleeding complications and things like that that we'll have to call the surgeon back in on. But at that stage of the game, I think the trend is to have a medical team taking care of the patients after surgery.
Right, right. The only thing about that is in the face of COVID-19, I know a lot of these silos pretty much came together, perhaps increasing the amount of collaboration that was going on in the hospitals, even with these surgeries.
I think you're right. And I think, you know, what we saw during, you know, I guess a year ago now, last spring, is that we saw the cardiothoracic surgeons being called in to do ICU work or to do ECMO work or to do something that took them away from the transplant arena. And then the ICU specialists, the pulmonologists and the cardiologists were all taking care of COVID patients. So the transplant activity nearly ceased for a period of time. And in fact, you know, there was a few months there that it was about 40 or 50% pre-pandemic levels. It's back up, you know, I think folks know. It's back up now to pre-pandemic levels, so all's good at this point.
Yeah, and at that time, there was concern, and I guess we'll see what the results of the putting on the back burner, if you will, some of the symptoms and surgeries that might have been done but were not done during COVID.
That's right. I mean, I think that's going to be something interesting to study over the years. And then the other thing with regard to transplant that'll be interesting to study is did any of the patients who didn't get transplanted during the worst of the pandemic suffer as a consequence? You know, in other words, did they not make it through the waiting period because the transplant activity had ceased? I'm not sure that the answer is in on that yet, but that'll be another interesting study.
Yeah, for sure. It's going to be interesting for a long time at this point with having been hit with that pandemic that most of us did not expect.
That's right. That's right.
So if I could just shift gears a little bit, a noticeably big topic in today in hospitals is physician and nurse burnout. Mm-hmm. Have there been times where you experienced this burnout? I know you touch on it in the book. And how were you able to combat that?
Yeah, I didn't really even have a name for it necessarily. You know, it's kind of odd to think that as I was experiencing, you know, what I think most would call burnout, I didn't really know that that's what I was experiencing. To me, it felt like empathy depletion. It felt like disillusionment with the job, frustration, physically tired, all that kind of stuff. I think all of it probably was burnout. I'm not a fan of that term because I think it's a little misleading in that it implies that it's an internal issue with the nurse or the doctor. And I think that that's sometimes the case, but I think it's more often the case that there are external factors that have led to physician and nurse unhappiness, disillusionment, you know, the healthcare system being very difficult to navigate these days. Conflict within the hospital that I write about some in the book, the electronic medical record, which I think is, you know, put real challenges on the workforce. These are all external factors that don't have much to do with an individual's mental health as much as they do with the job is just becoming kind of undoable. And since I left the front lines, I've had a number of nurses and doctors call me and kind of asked me, you know, how to deal with that, how to navigate that. I think it's exceedingly common right now.
Yeah, and I think most people don't realize the administrative responsibilities that doctors and nurses have now, and it takes so much time. You know, we thought as doctors we were just going to help people and, you know, operate on them if we were surgeons, or do our nursing if we're nurses, but then we have to spend all this time doing administrative duties, and it takes a lot of time, but it's necessary and it's required.
You're absolutely right about that. I mean, especially, you know, as I was practicing, I was in charge of a 55-person team, and I had all kind of administrative jobs that I had to do, and it's a burden. It really is. It gets you away from the patient care, which is why you signed up in the first place for the
right,
job.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Know, and so it's a tough environment for the folks, and I think COVID-19 definitely exposed it.
Yeah, and the states and the counties all want to keep track of all of the data, And for that, you know, there has to be input into the computers and into our software. So it's a challenge, big challenge. And it's put on the doctors. Yeah, it's almost like we need to hire a total administrative staff just to do that, separate from the physicians and the nurses.
No, I think that that's right. I think that, you know, what prevents hospitals from wanting to do that, of course, is cost. And I think that that's, you know, the cheapest labor, believe it or not, is just to get the, you know, the physicians in the hospital to do it, because you're already paying them anyway. And they're being asked to run, you know, harder and faster now. But it, you know, I think at the expense of their own well-being, and probably at the expense of their patients' well-being.
Yeah. I have to say, so first of all, I've gotten to know you a little bit as a person in a short period of time. And I want to speak as a patient, and a patient who has been on the operating table several times now, actually three times for open heart surgeries, two aborted heart transplant operations, and an LVAD surgery.
Wow.
And I want to say that having a surgeon or a team who I know to be excellent at their craft, but even more who are human beings and are personally invested in my survival and a successful healing process makes a world of difference for the patient and the family of the patient. And I'm sure that you've come to know this well, but I would like our listeners to understand that in our minds and hearts, you, the surgeon, becomes part of our family. And, and nobody that hasn't gone through this challenge as a patient can understand the gratitude that patients have for you and you, the surgeon, and the entire transplant team, as a matter of fact, including the nurses and support staff. So I needed to make that speech. So thank you.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And it means a lot to me. I read that loud and clear during the course of my career. I write in the book about this box that I kept underneath my desk, and it was just filled with pictures and letters and thank you notes and wedding invitations and you name it, birth announcements. And I really felt the appreciation, and part of, I think probably the major part of what drew me to the field is the relationship that you're able to develop with a relatively small group of patients when all things are considered. And the patients that I cared for did become like family to me, and I cared for them, you know, deeply. I think that, you know, obviously that, and I write about this in the book as well, the downside of that, of course, is that when we would lose a patient that I developed a relationship with, it was devastating. And I don't think that I developed a way to care less, or to, you know, to have a shield of armor around me or anything that you can think of to make me not feel those losses. But I intensely felt them, whether a patient was on our waiting list or whether or not we had already transplanted them. It was like losing, you know, a piece of our identity, really. And some of the, I think, most profound moments of my career have been, you know, talking with patients and, you know, explaining to their families what's going on. And the successes are exhilarating, but the down, you know, the deaths are absolutely devastating. Yeah. And I think over the course of the career, you really begin to feel that, you know, at least I did.
Yeah, thank you. And I know our listeners will appreciate that. And it helps in giving them hope for sure. So how do you maintain now a good emotional and mental balance doing the job that you're still doing as a consultant?
Yeah, so the sort of benefit to doing what I'm doing now is I can still help transplant patients, which is really all I wanted to do to begin with. I don't do it as much on the front lines one-on-one as I did before. But what I do now is I help transplant programs perform better. And so in my view, if the transplant programs that I work with perform better, then they help people, and that's good. So that gives me great satisfaction to be able to do that. But the one thing that I do a much better job of now that I'm not on the front lines is just staying connected with my family, my friends, my faith, and making sure that I don't isolate myself. I think isolation for any of us, but particularly in the healthcare field, is devastating. I think we have so much going on emotionally that we need to really connect with the people around us, not just be physically there, but be emotionally there. And so that's what I'm trying to do now in this kind of second phase of my career.
Yeah, wow. That's wonderful. The book is called Exhale, Hope, Healing, and a Life in Transplant by Dr. David Weil. It could be ordered on Amazon. I've already purchased my copy, and everyone in our global health community needs to buy this book. It's just wonderful. Dr. Weil, it's been my great honor to have you as a guest on The Heart of the Matter, and thank you so much for your insight into your world as a transplant surgeon and a consultant, and for continuing to provide hope for many of us. And on behalf of myself and my listeners, I thank you so much for all that you've done for our global community with your incredible dedication to your working in the area of heart and lung transplantation. And for sharing this time with us, I hope we can do this again soon.
It's been a privilege, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my privilege and our listeners' privilege as well, I'm sure. That is our podcast for today. Please join me next time for another intriguing, informative, and entertaining conversation. Please visit my website at www.drheart2heart.net. That's D-R-H-E-A-R-T, the numeral 2, H-E-A-R-T.net, for upcoming podcasts, or if you'd like me to host an online presentation for your group or organization. If you would like to be a guest on the Heart Guy Presents the Heart of the Matter podcast, please email me at theheartguyspeaks@gmail.com. Our podcast can be found on Apple iTunes, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Spotify. You just have to search The Heart Guy Presents the Heart of the Matter. And until next time, this is Dr. Gary Sherman, The Heart Guy, wishing you peace and hope.